This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Tired of not getting a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hello, hello. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. This week, we are connecting the dots between DEI, the N-word, and a massive bridge collapse. I know. How are all these things related? Well, we're going to find out today with Jean Denby, co-host of NPR's Code Switch.
What's good?
And Alana Wise, who covers race and identity for NPR. Jean, Alana, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Happy to be here.
Thank you for having us, friends.
Last week, a major bridge in Baltimore collapsed after a massive container ship ran into it. And the city's 39-year-old mayor, Brandon Scott, a Black man, arrived on the scene to address what had happened.
Everyone, this is an unthinkable tragedy. We have to first and foremost pray.
So hours later, a popular account on X tweeted, quote, "This is Baltimore's DEI mayor commenting on the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge. It's going to get so, so much worse. Prepare accordingly." Okay, it's kind of cryptic, omen, I don't know. So that comment circulated widely and left a lot of us being like, huh? DEI mayor? What does that mean? And what exactly is going to get so much worse? Alana, Jean, let's look at this term, DEI mayor, DEI being shorthand, of course, for diversity, equity, and inclusion, which often refers to initiatives within companies and organizations to address social inequities that can affect the workplace. What did you think that meant when you first heard DEI mayor? Alana, let's start with you.
I mean, I think that it's really funny in the worst way, in that it's just like sort of the latest iteration of saying the quiet thing without having to say it. In the same way that happened with woke, now it's happening with DEI, which is basically just to undercut this young Black man's accomplishments of running in a city that, by the way, is 60% Black and winning with 70% of the vote. But he's a DEI hire somehow, even though he was elected. It was just another way to sort of undercut this man's accomplishments and make him seem like he was in a position where he didn't belong.
What about Eugene?
It was funny because when I first saw the DEI mayor thing, it had already been metabolized and digested through like all the Black social media streams. So by the time I saw it, Black folks had already turned it into, had already reappropriated, I guess. Like, what's up, my DEIs?
Ryan for my DEIs.
I had to actually go back and see why everybody was saying this.
Oh my gosh.
The funny thing about that, I was like, they were just making the barely implied thing explicit, right? It was like, this is the way for people to say Black without saying Black, right? Because if you do that, you've crossed some bright line of what we consider to be understood etiquette around race and racism. Mm-hmm. It also matters a lot that he's the mayor of a city like Baltimore, the city that is associated with Black people. Remember a couple of years ago, Donald Trump referred to Baltimore as a disgusting, rodent-infested mess.
Yes.
You hear people refer to a lot of cities with big Black populations in these kind of shorthands. You always hear about crime in Chicago, right? People say Detroit. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They're using those things as shorthand for Black folks. With Baltimore, you get this like perfect storm of things that people already have negative connotations to because of Blackness, and DEI is doing, you know, just throw a little sprinkling of DEI,
a little razzle dazzle,
a little sazon on it.
A little cover, just a little cover.
Without actually saying the word out loud, the N word out loud.
Those were my thoughts too. I mean, you know, DEI, as you mentioned, a lot of like being the latest in a string of phrases that had one original meaning, but have come to describe very often a Black person who is thought to be unqualified or untrustworthy. We saw similar things happen with woke or critical race theory or affirmative action. And these aren't just terms that are used just by everyday people. You know, politicians use them too. Former President Trump, he says he cannot stand the word woke, even though he uses it quite a bit. And he's talked about his desire to start an anti-woke university.
You remember, like, way back in 2021, there was this conservative activist named Christopher Rufo who tweeted that he wanted to irradiate this whole concept of critical race theory. And I think he put critical race theory because it wasn't the kind of thing that people had any associations with, right? Like, at the time. Mm-hmm. And so this is what he tweeted. We have successfully frozen their brand, critical race theory, into the public conversation and are steadily driving up negative perceptions. We will eventually turn it toxic as we put all the various cultural insanities under that brand category. The goal is to have the public read something crazy in the newspaper and immediately think, critical race theory. We have decodified the term and will recodify it to annex the entire range of cultural constructions that are unpopular with Americans, end quote. And so he did that the way he sort of moved critical race theory from this concept that, you know, lived in law schools as an elective course, right, into the popular discourse was like he showed up on Fox News over and over and over again. He kept drumming home the point that critical race theory was this plot by the woke mob to indoctrinate American children with anti-American ideas. And it worked.
Actually, thinking specifically about DEI programs in the wake of the racial uprisings of 2020, lots of organizations had DEI programs, I think, already. But there were many organizations that didn't have them before. They got them in 2020. Mm-hmm. And if they already had them, there were new resources and there were new hires made to try to diversify workforces or make workplaces more comfortable for a wider variety of people. But we also have seen within the past year, a lot of those programs dry up. Now, I'm not going to speak on the efficacy of DEI programs. That's a separate conversation. Mm-hmm. But I do think that it is interesting that we also have seen Texas ban DEI initiatives in public universities. I mean, at the time of this conversation, a bunch of employees of University of Texas, Austin, have been let go from their jobs because they had to do with DEI. So it's interesting that as this phrase is rising in terms of being basically a stand-in for the N-word, DEI programs are also being eliminated or minimized at various organizations across the country.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's absolutely on purpose, right? If you take the phrase DEI that exists for, let's just give benefit of the doubt and say virtuous reasons, but then you make it seem like everyone who's in some position of note is only there by virtue of the fact that they're Black or only there by virtue of the fact they're a woman or mm-hmm. gender nonconforming, whatever. It makes it so much easier to blame, A, your own shortcomings on the fact that these people are just being let into the door and they didn't have to do anything to get there except for be born Black. And B, it just really works to undermine and undercut people's accomplishments. And it's one of those things where it just really sort of deepens an already negative perception of Black and brown people, minorities, whomever the case may be.
You know, in the tweet that I referenced earlier at the beginning of this conversation, the user, as you may recall, also said, quote, it's going to get so, so much worse. Prepare accordingly.
We're coming for you.
I want to know what y'all think. I mean, I think it sounds like someone perhaps saying that, you know, Black people in elected office is just going to always be a bad experience, or having this Black man as mayor, things are only going to get worse from here, from this bridge collapse, which is a messed up thing to say in general, right? But it's also wild that someone's first thought after this horrific, tragic incident was to find a way to be racist about the mayor who was addressing this problem as a mayor should. What do you think is the frustration underneath all of this?
So this thing that we see all the time is this real anxiety over a sense of demographic change in this country. This country is less and less white all the time. There are more and more brown people very visible in American life. There are a bunch of scholars who talk about the fact that, like, you can't have Donald Trump without Barack Obama. You need people to see this family at the center of American life to be sort of unnerved by that, to then have a backlash. And so, you know, a bridge collapses. You get this Black dude with this nice, clean lineup.
Cute jacket, too. Yeah.
He's 39, but he looks younger than that. You know what I mean? Like, if you have a bunch of ideas about America and American cities and who should be running them, and you see this young cat, it would just set you off. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, if you create enough of a panic in people, they'll do the rest. If you give people the idea of fear, they will absolutely do the rest. And in a lot of ways, it's human nature. Like, if someone tells you to be afraid, it's like, okay, now, why are you warning me? What's going on? Do I need to be watching my back? Yeah. But in this way, when it's something that's just, again, a moral panic and doesn't have any roots in warfare or nuclear bombs or anything like that. It's just, okay, you might start seeing a lot more DEIs around. Nobody wants that now, do we? And it just sort of lets you create whatever idea of what that actually might mean for you and your family, and allows you to be the most scared version of yourself possible, which ends up being quite dangerous for the people around you and for yourself, honestly.
Well, Jean, Alana, I have learned so much here. Thank you so much for coming in on and talking to me about this.
This is so much fun.
Thank you.
Well, and as a thank you to both of you, I'd like to teach you something by playing a game with you all. Can you stick around a tiny bit longer?
I have a learning spirit, yes.
A learning spirit.
I have a winning spirit, so let's go.
Okay, Alana says she's not playing. She said she's playing. Okay, all right. Well, we'll be right back with a little game I like to call, But Did You Know? Stick around.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Here's a familiar situation. You have a question about your credit card. You call the number for help and can't get a hold of anyone. If only you had a Discover card. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. A real person. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Homes.com. Homes.com knows having the right agent can make or break your home search. That's why they provide home shoppers with an agent directory that gives you a detailed look at each agent's experience, like the number of closed sales in a specific neighborhood, average price range, and more. It lets you easily connect with all the agents in the area you're searching, so you can find the right agent with the right experience and ultimately the right home for you. Homes.com. We've done your homework. This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who switch could save hundreds on car insurance. Get your quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. This message comes from the BBC with Where to Be a Woman. Join hosts Saatchi Kaul and Sophia Smith-Gaylor to find out where in the world women can live their best lives. Search for Where to Be a Woman from BBC Podcasts.
It's time for a little game I like to call, But Did You Know? Here's how it works. I'm going to share a story that's been making headlines this week. And as I give you some background on this story, I'll also ask you trivia related to it. But don't worry, it's all multiple choice. Okay, so the answer is in there somewhere. And the first one to blurt out the right answer, okay, gets a point. Person with the most points wins. And their prize, of course, is bragging rights. This is public radio. We're not giving away cars, okay? So are y'all ready?
Let's go.
Ready as I'll ever be.
Okay, let's get into it. We'll start out with an easy one, okay? This week, Forbes released its annual list of the world's billionaires with a B. According to their list, how many billionaires are there in the world right now? Is that number A, 257, B, 1,732, or C, 2,781?
C.
Ooh. B?
Alana's right. Ding, ding, ding. Correct. There are, according to Forbes magazine, at the moment, 2,781 billionaires in the world.
Wow.
And that is a record, actually. The number of billionaires is up by 26 since its last peak in 2021 following the COVID-19 lockdowns.
I'm not going to say nothing, get me in trouble, but that's probably not good for the world. Probably not good for the world.
All right. So right now we have Alana at 1 point, Jean.
Zero.
Goose egg.
You still got two more opportunities. Okay. So there are records all throughout this Forbes report, like the sheer amount of money concentrated in these people's pockets. They hold a record of $14.2 trillion.
Oh my God.
I know. Oh my God. You're probably asking, who's on this list, right? Who's on this list? Mm-hmm. That brings me to my next question. Which of these people appeared on this list for the first time? Was it A, Tom Brady, B, Taylor Swift, or C, Pharrell Williams?
B.
B.
You're both correct.
I said it first.
Gene, you said it first. You said it first.
What? During Women's History Month? Or that was last month. Whatever.
I'm sorry.
I only know that because that was in a script that we had yesterday.
Taylor Swift's net worth is roughly $1.1 billion. Her net worth, according to Forbes, puts her at a rank of 2,545th richest person in the world.
And how many billionaires did you say there were? 2,000 how many?
According to Forbes, there are currently 2,781 billionaires.
Oh, so she's not at the...
By the skin of her teeth.
Yeah, she just...
I mean, she just made it over the hump.
You think you're better than me,
exactly.
Taylor?
Exactly. She's a pauper. How's she going to eat? You know what I'm saying?
I know. I'm like, if I were her, I don't know. I might start having dinner with some of the people who are higher up on the list.
The babies need shoes.
All right. To recap the score, Gene, you are at 1 point. Alana, you are at 1 point. So whoever gets this last one is the winner.
Street Fighter.
So without further ado,
round three.
I bet you're wondering where all this wealth is concentrated.
Ooh.
So which of these countries has a record 813 billionaires within its borders? Is it A, the United Kingdom, B, China, or C, the good old USA?
United States.
B, China.
Gene, you are correct. Ding, ding, ding. The United States.
I tried to go with the one I didn't.
I know. Well, also, you think like China has more people than the United States, right?
More,
so you're more people, more opportunities for billionaires possibly. But no, the United States has the highest number of billionaires. And in total, they hold $5.7 trillion. And not to make a point, but that's about 68 times the amount of money budgeted for the United States Department of Education.
Oh, please make the point. Please make the point. That is unfathomable. Oh, my God.
I don't know. At this point, I'm like, I might crack one of these open and just see who's single. You know what I'm saying? Start sending out resumes. Like, look. All right. Well, Gene, congratulations.
I win.
You won. But did you know?
Stolen valor.
There's always next time. There's always next time. Congratulations, Gene, on your win. Woo-hoo. I hope you use these facts to make your own $1 billion. Alana, Gene, thank you so much for joining me. This was so much fun.
Appreciate you, sis.
Thank you.
That was NPR's Gene Demby and Alana Wise. Coming up, I'm getting into the boys at the NCAA who are trying to get their own bag by unionizing. I'll be right back.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares Betterment's philosophy on investing.
No matter the amount of money you have, it's always good to be invested. It's always good to start early. It's always good to save. And the power of being consistent in your habits is really the path to long-term wealth.
Get started at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Progressive. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit their website to get a quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. Then just choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares Betterment's philosophy on investing.
No matter the amount of money you have, it's always good to be invested. It's always good to start early. It's always good to save. And the power of being consistent in your habits is really the path to long-term wealth.
Get started at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
We are reaching the final furious stages of March Madness. And regular listeners will know that I'm not a huge sports girly, but I've kind of fallen in love with basketball and all the ankle breaking and trash talking that comes with it.
Clark steps back, fires, you bet!
But as millions of people watch these players spill sweat on the courts, dazzle us with dramatic plays and nail-biting final shots, I have to ask, why are these players still considered amateurs? And sure, they aren't playing in a professional league, but they are making these schools buckets of money. And yet, they don't get a paycheck from them and have few protections, if any. Now, this isn't just a sports issue, this is a labor issue. And it may sound ridiculous, but college athletics may have some big lessons for all of us in how we value work across different fields. To help us break this down, I'm joined by sports business reporter Amanda Kristovich, an assistant professor of legal studies and business at Boise State University, Sam Ehrlich, to demystify the student athlete and tell us what the actual reality of collegiate athletics is. Amanda, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Thank you for having me.
Sam, welcome to the show. It's so good to have you.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy to be here.
Oh, that's what I love to hear. I'm happy to have y'all here. One of the things that's really been interesting to me about this whole situation as somebody who covers culture is how we define a quote unquote amateur and how that can be used as a reason not to pay someone. Something that blew my mind when preparing to talk to you and doing research on this whole topic is that the NCAA actually came up with the term student athlete. What's the significance of the NCAA being the organization to come up with that designation?
I get really excited about this question because it's something that I talk to my editors about all the time and about why Front Office Sports only uses the phrase student athlete in quotes. It was created as a legal defense against the concept of athletes being employees and being entitled to workers' compensation. So like in the journalism space, to use the phrase student athlete when it's not a quote from someone else, like in my opinion, is almost like this inadvertent lack of objectivity. Like you're writing from inside the NCAA's rule book and their legal defense, and you're legitimizing a legal argument rather than actually just using a word that you think denotes a certain group of people.
Yeah, Amanda hit the nail on the head. Former NCAA President Walter Byers has been very open about the fact that the term student athlete was developed exclusively, explicitly to combat workers' compensation litigation. Because decades ago, you had various cases in various states where players who were injured on the field or even in some cases, you know, passed away due to injuries related to playing sports, they or their beneficiaries would file these workers' compensation claims saying, we are employees. We are employees by virtue of this employment contract that we have with our schools to play sports in exchange for an athletic scholarship, and therefore we should receive workers' compensation protection. Workers' compensation is not available to non-employees in most cases. So in that sense, if the NCAA is able to argue successfully that they're not employees, they're student athletes instead, then the schools are not required to pay workers' compensation.
It also makes me think about the parallels that exist between these student athletes and Olympic athletes. There are some people who have compared these two groups because technically Olympic athletes, many of them are technically amateurs, as in they're not professional league playing athletes. Like you may compete in handball or shot put, but chances are you're not doing that professionally in the rest of your life. I think that there's no doubt in my mind that an Olympian is a quote unquote professional athlete. And often some of them may be paid through different sponsorships and things like that. So if your run of the mill Olympic champion is technically also an amateur, what does that word really mean in sports?
I think the Olympic example is kind of a perfect one. I think it's right on point because the Olympics gave up this whole kind of firm amateurism idea years ago. And when their sponsorships, when their advertising opportunities got high enough, the athletes started saying, well, why are you able to get all this money and I'm not able to make money? That was years ago for the Olympics. The NCAA is still holding on to name, image, and likeness.
I want to point out, you mentioned the term name, image, and likeness, or NIL for short. Can you explain what that is and why it's such an important part of this conversation?
So the thing about NIL that I think a lot of the experts have explained to me is that a company can't just take a picture of you and use it in an advertisement without your permission, compensation, et cetera, right? So the NCAA athletes were actually signing that right away when they got to school.
Right. They recently won those rights back.
So the new NIL rights that they have now, they're not really new rights, but the employment question, I think, was the natural next step beyond NIL.
And that next step has been taken by the men's basketball team at Dartmouth College. The team voted to join a union, and they had a lot of reasons to want to do this. Because they were classified as student athletes, aka amateurs, they weren't eligible for healthcare that covers out-of-pocket expenses. So if they were injured, they paid. They also couldn't receive any compensation, which for some could make paying for healthcare difficult if they didn't have rich parents or second jobs. And last, because Dartmouth is an Ivy League school, they also weren't given athletic scholarships. All the while, the school collects stacks of money on the backs of their performance, as well as their name, image, and likeness. So right before March Madness kicked off, history was made because the Dartmouth College men's basketball team was successful. They became the first unionized college team in the U.S. So to get into the Dartmouth case, for those who don't know, one of the students who led this was already a part of another union on campus. That to me was notable because this student saw that as an athlete, he was using his body to provide some sort of service to the university in a similar way to how he was at his cafeteria job. He sees it as being more than just an amateur. And I think this really sets up one of the big questions I have on why they are not considered employees.
A big part of Dartmouth's defense here and a big part of really the entire defense of every school in the NCAA, if they're faced with these kind of employment arguments, is, well, they're just students. They're just student athletes. They're not employees. They're just students doing this extracurricular activity. But when you have this defense, as you said, Brittany, of, well, I mean, these students are doing these other jobs in these other, you know, areas of campus, and they're part of a union as well. You know, that argument, you definitely see some holes in it.
Absolutely. The question isn't really, in my opinion, about whether or not students can also be employees of their universities, because that's done and dusted to me. The question is whether athletics constitutes employment, which brings me to the next sort of big argument, which was about control. One of the things that I've learned in covering this and other cases that involve labor law is that it's not really about how much money you make. That's the sort of rhetoric that we see online, but legally it's about control. It's about, do they tell you when to wake up? Do they tell you when to go to sleep? Do they tell you what to eat? When you travel with the team, can you go get a haircut without someone's permission? Do you have to weigh a certain amount? When are you allowed to schedule classes, right? Where are you allowed to live on campus? All of these things are controlled.
I was going to say, all of those things, having friends who played college sports, all of that stuff is controlled by your team.
Then the question is, well, does that constitute employment? In the Dartmouth case, the regional director's ruling said, yes, it does.
That idea of control as employment is so interesting. And to catch the listener up on what you just said, the regional directors are part of the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB. And they're the ones who legally determine whether or not people can start a union. So they said, yes, these student athletes are employees. But what has Dartmouth's response been?
Their PR response has been, we are fighting this every single step of the way. And that while we recognize lots of unions on our campus and employment rights on our campus, we will not be recognizing any employment rights whatsoever for these men's basketball players.
Dartmouth has actually, in their statements, have said, we're not only going to appeal this to the National Labor Relations Board, if the full NLRB finds that these athletes are employees, we're going to voluntarily and consciously commit an unfair labor practice by refusing the bargain, which would violate federal law, which would violate the National Labor Relations Act, just so we can appeal that to a federal appellate court if they have to.
Okay, so some college players recognize that they have all the characteristics of employees, and players have tried to start unions before. What are some of the obstacles they've come up against? I think about the Northwestern men's football team. This was like years ago, and they failed to organize because of a technicality. Sam, can you explain that?
Part of the key distinction between Northwestern versus Dartmouth is because the National Labor Relations Act, which really controls the unionization process, only applies to private employers and only applies to private sector employees. Mm. And that gets really interesting and really complicated when it comes to college sports because we have all these public institutions.
Right.
So if you have a school like Northwestern, which at the time, the Big Ten was all public institutions except for Northwestern, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense from the NLRB's perspective to exert jurisdiction over just one school. But what makes Dartmouth interesting is that Dartmouth, the Ivy League, they're all private institutions.
So the NLRB didn't decide whether or not the Northwestern players were employees. They just decided that them starting a union wouldn't work within their league. So they could have been employees. But there's actually a model for how to deal with unionizing workers who work in different kinds of places of employment, a union that I myself am a part of, SAG-AFTRA. Sam, you and a couple colleagues wrote about a potential solution modeled after SAG-AFTRA.
Yeah, absolutely. We recently published a paper that proposed a structure to call a college out of the union that's really modeled after the entertainment union SAG-AFTRA, because it has this one very flexible and very general collective bargaining agreement at kind of a national level, but then leaves a lot of local governance to smaller local governing unions, kind of sub-unions, if you will, to handle more kind of day-to-day on a, you know, in particular industries and particular kind of areas. And we feel like a model for that for college athletes would be really helpful simply because of the fact that what they want are going to differ significantly from athlete to athlete, right, and especially from sport to sport, from school to school.
Yeah.
Some athletes, especially at Power 2 level, especially in the Big Ten Conference and the SEC, where these conferences are making millions of dollars, they may want a big chunk of that. But for a lot of Ivy League athletes, they probably want an athletic scholarship to be able to go to school, to be able to afford these Ivy League institutions. So that may be something they want to collectively bargain for instead. Other athletes may be focused more on health and safety protections, the ability to get second opinions. All these different things are part of collective bargaining agreements in all the professional sports. So I think having kind of these different subunions to represent the athletes specifically from sport to sport, from university to university, I think would be a lot more beneficial.
One last question. How does this NCAA story complicate our view of labor rights in this country? How does it change what we consider work is?
So it's a really interesting question. And I actually published a paper with a couple of my colleagues last year that compares name, image, and likeness as we see it right now in college sports to the gig economy, to working for Uber, working for Lyft, because it's kind of a similar thing where the purported employers here are steadfastly claiming that the workers are not employees. But at the same time, these employers are able to make a lot of money. They're able to avoid, even beyond paying minimum wage, they're avoiding being required to provide a lot of the employment benefits that employees are provided. All these different employment benefits don't apply to gig economy workers. They're not true independent contractors who are running their own business, but they're also not true employees as well. So you're seeing kind of a tug of war situation in both ends right now, where the workers are certainly trying to be employees and the employers are certainly trying to make them be independent contractors or otherwise non-employees.
Amanda, any final thoughts?
Forgive me if I'm beating around the bush here a little bit, but the last time in the history of the United States that there was a large group of folks who were providing free labor, there was also an economic argument for all of the horrors that would befall the economy and society if those folks were given their full economic human rights.
Well, oh my gosh, you both have raised some really incredible questions about this. I am very curious and very excited to see how this conversation develops. I'd love to thank you both for coming on the show today and talking with me about this. This was a really great conversation. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks again to Amanda Kristovich and Sam Ehrlich. This episode of It's Been a Minute was produced by
Barton Girdwood,
Alexis Williams,
Liam McBain,
Corey Antonio Rose.
Our editor is
Jessica Plachek.
Engineering support came from
Patrick Murray,
Gilly Moon,
David Greenberg.
We had fact-checking help from
Barclay Walsh.
Our executive producer is
Verilyn Williams.
Our VP of programming is
Yolanda Sanguini.
All right, that's all for this episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. Talk soon.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor, the NPR Wine Club. Get the world of wine delivered to your door. When you join the NPR Wine Club, you'll receive the stories behind every bottle and favorite NPR shows and personalities arriving in liquid form, like Weekend Edition Cabernet and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Zinfandel. The NPR Wine Club is a delicious way to support NPR's programming. If you're 21 or older, uncork a special offer at nprwineclub.org/podcast.
Every time you drive your car, have a package delivered, or get on a plane, you're polluting the climate. But it doesn't have to be that way.
Nature is powerful. Why don't we use it to our advantage?
Meet the people working on cleaner ways to get around on Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR. Transportation Climate Solutions on Here and Now Anytime, wherever you listen to podcasts.